I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our community conversation about the Me Too moment and movement. We're going to talk about the ways it is changing conduct and affecting different communities. My guests are author and psychologist Jessica Benjamin, Dr. Felicity Kelkhorst of the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center, and professional cuddler Lisa Meese. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are going to be talking today about the Me Too moment and movement. We're going to be talking about the ways it is changing conduct and affecting different communities. If you want to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are author and psychologist Jessica Benjamin, Dr. Felicity Kelkhorst. She is counseling faculty with the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center, and person of all trades, Renaissance person, Lisa Meese, professional cuddler and consultant who does coaching regarding consent and boundaries. So welcome to all of you. It is good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So we probably ought to start. We have done an earlier program on this, the whole Me Too movement and moment. And I think it's probably wise to start the conversation about, you know, why it has exploded and is dominating discourse in the fashion that it is right now. I don't want to talk about the rights and wrongs, because I think we can all agree that much of the behavior we have seen is wrong here. But, you know, that behavior is not new. What it was that sort of brought this to the tipping point that we are at now. And I'll start with Jessica Benjamin on that one.
So, I mean, self-evidently, a very major piece of why this movement came to the fore when it did has to do with the election process during 2016. The way in which Hillary Clinton was treated during that election process, the way in which sexual misbehavior violations were tolerated in a person who was going to become president of the United States, and the ensuing protests that occurred immediately after his election, which was a massive, massive protest by millions of women and their supporters. So I think that we have to see that as the immediate context for the fact that this protest against sexual violation was finally taken up in a way that it never has been.
Felicity.
Well, you know, it's... I think it needs to be said that we've had the statistics for years that show that 1 in 4 women are harassed, if not worse, before the age of 20. So it's something where typically older men prey on younger women. And there are also statistics that say 1 in 7 men are harassed, violated in some way. And I've always wondered if those statistics were low because mm-hmm. men don't feel that they should talk about this if it happens, even more so than women, perhaps. So what happens to someone who has their boundaries violated is that there's shame, there's self-blame. The person has to work through all that and the anger at the person who did it to them to come to a place of feeling whole again. And that takes a lot of work. So I think what's important about the Me Too movement is that women are coming together to support each other, to say, this is not okay, this shouldn't happen, it needs to stop.
Lisa.
And this is very much a tipping point. These things have been building for years, mm-hmm. going back to things like Antioch College in 2008 being the first university to put in an affirmative consent rule that not just no means no, but you need an affirmative yes for consent to be in place. And these abuses are really not about sex, they're about power. Mm-hmm. And this consent thing is very unsettling to people, because if we begin to take this seriously in all areas, that abusing power is not okay, it unsettles a lot. And we heard during the election a very famous quote that when you're a star, they let you do it. And this has been an understanding.
Thank you for only doing part of that quote,
yes,
by the way.
Yes, indeed.
Keeping me out of trouble with the FCC.
There we go.
Sure.
Something stay off the air.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the fundamental thing that underlies this. It's our understanding of power is who do you get to hurt and who do you get to abuse to prove that you have power. And as we shrink the list of types of people you get to hurt with impunity, it unsettles all sorts of structures. And this is when you get to a tipping point, things start to fall over. And I think that's what we're seeing here.
Well, and I guess that brings us to the, there are many other things, and maybe we will loop back, but I think you brought it to sort of the crux of this. How is this tipping point going to change things and change conduct going forward? I'll start with Lisa, but I'm going to take it back around again. I want everybody's thoughts on this.
So if we take a broad view of this, it changes everything. What do you do as a pushy salesperson if it's no longer okay to push for a yes when they really mean no? In terms of interpersonal relationships, it brings the complexity of it more into the light, where the models that we've seen in movies and TV shows where you just go for it and the script writer knows that it is okay with the person you're grabbing and kissing. That's not how real life works. We need to shift those models. But everything, the rules are all up in the air right now and no one has a coherent set of new rules. We need some new vocabulary to talk about this, because we have exactly one word in the popular vernacular for consent violation, and it's a very loaded word, and there are more degrees to it than that. So it's we're in a place where everything is sort of unsettled, and we don't know how it will settle back in.
Felicity.
My hope for this cultural moment is that we get to rethink what we think it means to be human, because, you know, for generations now, for heterosexuals anyway, there's a list of attributes for males, there's a list of attributes for females. I actually think that this has a lot to do with GLBT rights as well, because when gay and lesbian and trans persons begin to have rights, they enter the public discourse, which can be very unsettling for heterosexuals who've always lived with this list of rules. You know, men are like this, women are like this. I'm old enough to remember first wave feminism, where the idea was that women get to be like men. Now I'm hoping that we can consider that it's a human attribute to be empathic, to be sensitive to the feeling of needs of others. Why should we say that that's only in the female column? You know, can't men be empathic and caring human beings as well? I'm sure they can, but do we give cultural permission for that, or do we say that's men being soft? You know, it's a lot about how we construct gender.
Jessica.
Well, I absolutely agree with what Lisa said before, which is that the question of whom you get to hurt with impunity is central to power relations. And it's also central to our understanding of masculinity in this society. And if I may, I would use the word patriarchy to describe historically the condition that Felicity was just alluding to, in which it's not simply that there are gender roles, but that male domination, men's domination over women and over their bodies, has been a model for many other forms of dominating the bodies of people who are weaker. Whether we're talking about the history of slavery or we're talking about torture in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, there's a certain way in which power can be materialized as the ability to dispose with impunity over others' bodies, use their labor, torture them, dispose over their children, and so forth, that is embedded in our history. But at the same time, we have, and I think this often is underrepresented, we have a condition in which masculinity is actually very fragile, because if you need to be able to prove your manhood by denying all vulnerability, by pretending to be John Wayne, by displaying the kind of toughness that the current president pretends to, all kinds of things are being hidden and repudiated. And the danger, in a way, is that the humiliation is going to catch up with you. So that humiliation has to keep being projected onto the other. Every time you're in danger of being humiliated, you have to find somebody else to put that experience of humiliation into. And that's where certain kinds of women, I think, are used by certain kinds of men to project humiliation into, to actually be a sort of dumping ground for their container for their humiliation. And so masculinity has included, shall we say, permission to use others in that way, or, and sometimes even that's a way to validate your masculinity in relation to other, let's say, young men, is to show that you're capable of humiliating a helpless girl. So
or helpless
we really
men.
Have some very, very painful things to tangle with here.
Lisa, you want to jump in?
Oh, and you said a helpless girl. It's not only women who are victims of this. It is also men. It's who can you put under your finger? And the term toxic masculinity is so often misunderstood to be, well, men are toxic. And that's not what the term says. It's that this construct of manliness, that you can lose your man card if you cry, or if you attempt to have a sexual encounter and don't get to, then what a horrible place to put men, that they don't get to be who they are unless they're dominating others.
So, Felicity, yeah, I see you nodding your head.
Yes, I'm glad that the word patriarchy was brought up, because it does imply a social system where some people have to be on top by virtue of their birth or social status, and other people have to be on the bottom. And we are moving to a place in the world where we must work together, or literally sink together as the seas rise. And you might not think that this has anything to do with the global problems of climate change, but I think that it absolutely does. Humans have to learn to do better with one another. We do not have a world that we can just trash anymore, and we have to stop trashing each other in order to move into that better world.
So, Felicity, I'm going to ask this of you real quickly, and we're coming up on a break, so it may be a more complicated question than that. But this is a much larger discussion, obviously, than what the popular perception is, that it's really all about, you know, sexual and gender politics, by and large.
Right, right.
And, you know, in what ways are we going to see that manifested next, do you think?
Well, I think in terms of the status of women worldwide, if women had choices over their lives, as many North American women do, but few other women in the world do, if they had a choice to be educated, to work, to choose when to give birth, we could see poverty disappear in a generation or two, because women would be empowered to provide for their families in ways that they can't now, because they're under the thumb of men who control their lives.
We are talking about the Me Too moment and movement here on No Limits. We're talking about the ways it's changing conduct and affecting communities and is likely to shape the ways that we're all going to live together in the days and years ahead. My guests are author and psychologist Jessica Benjamin, Dr. Felicity Kelcor. She is consulting or counseling faculty with the Christian Theological Seminary, and Lisa Meese, a professional cuddler who also coaches in regard to consent and boundaries. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or find us on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the Me Too moment and movement, about how really it is going to shape the way we live and shape the way we interact with each other in the days and years ahead. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are author and psychologist Jessica Benjamin, Dr. Felicity Kelcor. She is counseling faculty with the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center. And Lisa Meese, who wears many hats. She's a professional cuddler and coaches individuals now, but eventually it will be organizations and corporations in regard to consent and boundaries. So, Jessica, before we dive back into this larger subject, I probably ought to point out you're based in New York, but you are going to be here in Indianapolis tomorrow, right?
That's right.
Doing what?
I'll be lecturing in the program that Felicity has organized. So she can tell you more about the exact auspices of the program, but I will be lecturing on the confluence of these issues that we're talking about now and other issues regarding how we repair social injuries and trauma.
And can you give us a taste of how we repair social injuries
well,
and trauma?
No.
No?
I don't know I could give you a taste of repair
okay.
right now. But I think what I can say is that I'm trying to talk about what the human developmental origins and basis for the capacity to take responsibility and repair injuries versus collapsing into states of shame and blame, where a lot of avoidance of responsibility is covered over, for instance, by people in authority. So part of what we're talking about here right now, this Me Too moment, is a moment, of course, where people are trying to call to account those who've had power and who've done harm. But there's also the question, how do we repair that harm by making it possible for some form of acknowledgement and reparation to occur so that there's actually social healing? And I think this is something that we as a culture are very lacking in. We lack restorative justice. We tend toward punitive ideas of justice. And so part of what I'm trying to show is what are the real psychological advantages and how do we develop the capacity to really create social healing rather than punishment? So I'm interested in that for those who have transgressed and violated, as well as for those who are their victims. I don't think real satisfaction comes through punishment and vengeance.
I've seen, obviously, both of you. I want to give both of you. Lisa, we'll start with you, but I saw you both nodding your heads in affirmation pretty emphatically.
Yeah, a lot of the language that we use to talk about this in the Me Too moment is ramping people's emotions up. When we say someone is a monster, in a way, we're absolving them of blame. Mm. Because if this person is a monster, then this is their nature and they couldn't help it. Instead, these are monstrous behaviors that someone chooses to engage in. But these are choices that people are making, and they can make different choices, and you can use different behaviors and cause less harm. Mm-hmm. And the restorative justice piece, I'm so glad you said that, because that's a piece we don't even know what that would look like, really.
Yeah, I mean, first, I want to give Felicity a chance to weigh in, too, because she was nodding her head up and down as well.
So before we lose the reference, I just want to make it clear what's bringing Dr. Jessica Benjamin to town. You know, she's a leading relational feminist psychoanalyst, and she's coming to speak in this program lecture series at Christian Theological Seminary, which has been going for 20 years now, Spirituality and Psychotherapy. So most Americans say they're spiritual, they're religious, they care about soul and the well-being of others, but we don't always know how to do that wisely from a psychological point of view. So how to bring the two together? I should mention, her lectures are 7 to 9 on Friday, tomorrow, the 16th, and 9 to 3 on Saturday. If you haven't registered already, you can do it until midnight tonight at the CTS website or show up at 7 tomorrow.
What is the URL if they do want to register?
www.cts.edu. Very
simple. Okay, and there will be a button or whatever that they can click on right away.
On the main website. And just to speak to
real quickly,
sure.
Before that, okay. Before we move on from the logistics here,
is
there a cost if people want to attend?
Yes, there is a cost. Students have a way to attend at low cost. You can put, if you're a student, you can put UIndy into the promo and register for $25. Mm-hmm. But everybody else at this point has to pay.
And how much is that?
So it depends if you just come to Friday night or Saturday both, but at this point it's $125 for both, and that's because we do expect professionals, therapists, and we also have chaplains, ministers, just people who are interested in this topic.
Okay, I've delayed you long enough from jumping in on the topic here, but I apologize.
And I should say, there are continuing education units for people with licensure, so it's a good deal for them, put it that way. So, my thought was just that, I may have lost it now, let's see. Oh, yeah, shame and blame, restorative justice. On the psychological piece, we don't always understand how another person is feeling when we interact with them. And we were talking during the break about how it's very important, for example, that Antioch College has people say affirmatively, yes, I want to interact with you physically. Because what has often not been understood, and I'm teaching a course on trauma right now, women can have a freeze reaction when they don't feel comfortable about how they're being approached. And that literally shuts down the speech centers in the brain. And you'll hear guys say, well, she didn't say anything, so it must have been okay. Physically, people, when they're frightened, cannot respond.
Well, some of that is also, I remember something that stuck with me for years when I was a newspaper reporter back in the early 90s when the Des Moines Register broke sort of newspaper tradition, convention, and did a story about, a survivor of sexual assault who wanted to be named and said, in effect, the shame here is not mine. It's someone else's. I did a series on rape and sexual assault here in Indianapolis, and I remember talking with one of the survivors who said, you know, something that so many people don't understand when they say, well, how did you let this happen? I know, Lisa. Don't.
You're both nodding our heads on that one.
I'm not advocating the response.
I know it's not you.
It's not me. But she said that's, you also have to take into consideration so much of the social conditioning here, too, that men in our culture, you know, they play football, they do things that are rough, confrontational, and at some level they're used to being hit. Many women, though, you know, at the first sign of violence, because they have no frame of reference for that, they shut down. And beyond at that point, you know, I think, and it's picking up on Felicity's point here, any sort of rational or coherent response becomes difficult, if not impossible. Since I'm amplifying Felicity's point, I ought to give her the first crack, but I will bring it back to you, Lisa.
Yeah, so just really understanding how trauma works, how it affects people, and I do think this goes to restorative justice, because I heard, you know, Abu Ghraib was mentioned, and people being tortured were mocked, and I don't think that you can understand what it feels like to be physically violated unless you've either been there yourself or you've really empathically listened to the experience of somebody who has been, and not just said, oh, you're faking it, you know. No, people have a whole body physical reaction that affects their mind, affects their speech, it affects everything under traumatic circumstances.
Lisa.
And that is absolutely true. And when somebody freezes, if you are paying attention and you care whether they're okay or not, you can read that as a no. The research shows that men can read a soft no, which is where you decline without using the word no, in any situation except sexual. And so if you think about it, we very seldom use the word no when we turn each other down. If you say, would you like to go to lunch after we get done on the radio? My likely response is, I've already eaten, or, oh, I wish I could, or another time, right? And the word no isn't there, but you understand that I'm not going to leave and go to lunch, right? And that's very common. But when it's a sexual situation, it gets confounded by the fact that we have taught little boys from the time they started talking about relationships that if they fail, if they're still a virgin, they're not really a man. If they try to have sex with a woman and fail, they're not really a man. There's all of this conditioning that this is a battle. I mean, the primary metaphor we use for sex is baseball. And let me tell you, if there's a loser in your sexual encounter, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. We are talking about the Me Too moment and movement here on No Limits. We're talking about the ways it's going to change life as we go forward. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Jessica, I want to ask, because as all of you were talking, I'm thinking of all of the ways that this manifests itself in our culture right now. And I am even thinking, and I apologize, it's a masculine frame of reference, but I am, of course, a man. But I'm, you know, I was thinking, and it's one of the things that's going to mark me as an old fogey. One of the parts of our culture now that I abhor the most, and it is in a sports, and that is, you know, the act of taunting a defeated opponent. There is something about that, and I apologize to my audience, I try normally not to express opinions in this forum, but there's something about that just rubs me the wrong way. But it is now so inherently part of how men interact in so many ways.
Well, I wasn't exactly expecting that ball.
I know. I apologize.
No, it's okay. But I think the overall issue that you're speaking to is the issue of humiliation. And I was trying to say before that if you are constantly afraid of humiliation, and if you're constantly defending yourself against humiliation, you have to find, shall we say, someone else into whom you can put that experience. We call that projection. Mm-hmm. And you fantasize that, no, they are the humiliated person, and so that must mean that now I'm not the humiliated one. It's as if you can get rid of a bad experience by imagining that it's not you who's having it, it's someone else. And sometimes, of course, you have to make that someone else have that experience. So I think part of what we, I mean, I see, and maybe this sounds too radical, but I see a kind of continuum or line between taunting your opponents and, say, torturing your opponents. I see, I mean, it's not, you know, I'm not saying there's only one step away necessarily, but there's a line that...
Yeah, you've started down the path.
Yes, and or at any rate, you may not have started down that path, but this path is the same path. It's the same, and certainly that's what we were seeing in Abu Ghraib, was like just the sheer effort to humiliate these people who weren't even accused of anything. So that effort to get rid of your own humiliation, we have to trace back to experiences of shame that are occurring very early on, for instance, in the peer group, let's say through bullying. And you don't have to have even been the victim of the bullying. You could have just been the bystander, but you saw what the consequences were if you couldn't protect yourself and ended up being the one holding the weakness card, the vulnerability card, because you were in some way other or smaller or whatever it was. And that sense that you're always one step away from being humiliated is, I think, a crucial part of American male culture that we're seeing result in some of these violations, I think, that appear to be about sexuality. But as my other two conversationalists have been saying, it's very important to see that they're actually about failure. They're about winning and losing.
This is going to be, you know, most of the focus of this moment and movement have been about how it is going to liberate women, but it sounds like we're really talking about liberating everyone.
Absolutely.
Here. Well, Felicity. I always think that liberation that is really liberation is liberation for everyone. I don't think there's, because I think being a perpetrator is ultimately a very difficult and unpleasant position, even though people may find ways to dissociate in order to, as we call it, that is to say, really put this into some other box and close the box and pretend you're not having the experience. I think in reality, the psychological insecurity that goes along with being in the perpetrator position is manifold.
Felicity.
I like to think that I see a future world through my seminary students, because in seminary you have men who are more empathic than most men, women who are more willing to be leaders than most women, and you know, it's good to feel that humans can express their human qualities without regard to the genderless of how men have to be or women have to be. People are different, and people should be able to express their gifts.
Yeah, I was thinking, actually, go ahead, Lisa, you wanted to jump in.
Oh, you know, a lot of the fear that I hear, especially from men in organizations around this, is that they're going to lose out, that they're not going to know how to interact. And as Margaret Atwood says in The Handmaid's Tale, better is never better for everyone. And the men who think that being a supervisor means they're allowed to sexually dominate or have sex with their employees, a poll that came out yesterday says 23% of men believe that around the world, that's not going to be better. But as my co-guests have said, being a perpetrator isn't a happy place to be.
We are talking about the Me Too moment and movement here on No Limits. My guests are author and psychologist Jessica Benjamin, Dr. Felicity Kellkors, counseling faculty with the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center, and Lisa Meese, professional cuddler and consultant regarding consent and boundaries. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the Me Too moment and movement. We're talking about the ways it is changing life. My guests are author and psychologist Jessica Benjamin, who's going to be in town tomorrow, speaking here in Indianapolis on Friday and Saturday. Dr. Felicity Kelkhorst, she is counseling faculty with the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center. And Lisa Meese, professional cuddler and a consultant now primarily with individuals, but also soon to be with organizations and businesses regarding consent and boundaries. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. So I want to give Lisa a chance to sort of finish the point she was making, because I think it gets to one of the crucial ones. The concern I hear, particularly from, and it's right now, primarily men, in the professional world, is they're saying, oh gosh, I don't know how to conduct myself anymore. I don't know what the rules are or what they should be, which is, of course, one of the things that happens at tipping points like this, where we have to arrive at new understandings. But what counsel would, and I'll give everyone a chance at that, would you advise, and again, primarily men, but I hear a few women say the same thing. What advice and counsel would you offer them? I'll start with Lisa and then take it around the horn.
I just put a post out on my blog at holdingspacellc.com. You can find it there on the rules for organizational relationships now that time's up, which is the other hashtag that's going around Hollywood mm-hmm. with this. And a lot of it mirrors the model of enthusiastic consent, which I know a lot of people haven't heard of, because when I talk to people, they say, what is that? Mm-hmm. And so if you're not familiar with it, it's not a no means no, but rather a, if somebody isn't a yay, yes, absolutely, to a sexual encounter with you, why would you want to be in a sexual situation with them? And I think people kind of intuitively and theoretically understand that if hugging this person or kissing this person is going to make them feel like they need a shower, you probably don't want to do that. But putting that into practice in the real world is a different thing. So the model of a consent culture really has three pieces. You need to know what your own boundaries are, and that's harder than it sounds, right? Because we live in a world that tells us what our boundaries are supposed to be based on the body we're born in. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that don't mm-hmm. quite really work in that model. But so know what your boundaries are. Be willing to communicate them. So there's that social stigma. If you need to say no to somebody, but they might not like you, or they might not give you the raise or the new job, or they might fire you. And so those two pieces are skills you can learn. And then the third piece is we need a preponderance of people in this culture to care what other people's boundaries are. And with those three things, we can shift towards a place where everybody gets to be a person and gets to live in a respected way.
Felicity.
Yeah, I mean, being a therapist, of course, I tend to think about the need for healing. So people who have been wounded themselves may wall off their own wounds to the point where they become heartless towards themselves as well as others. And then, you know, the thing about touch, I mean, touch is so important. We all need touch. It literally makes us healthier to be touched by those we love. And I started my career as a chaplain, you know, holding hands in the hospital. People feel less pain when somebody holds their hand. But at the same time, if you just socially reach out to touch somebody without saying, is it all right, you know, for me to touch you or give you a hug, you don't know how that person experienced this. I'm thinking of my aunt, who's been gone a number of years now, who was angry with her minister because as she left church, he would touch her on the arm. Now, that sounds perfectly innocuous, mm-hmm. but she didn't like it. And it colored her whole sense of that church and that minister to be touched without, you know, being asked if she wanted that touch.
Jessica.
Leads me in one direction, and then my approach as a social thinker in another. As a social thinker, when I hear Lisa say, well, you have to be able to say no to someone even though you're afraid they might reject you or it might impair your job situation, there's a part of me that just as a feminist thinks, I shouldn't have to do that in the context of ever worrying about how it's going to affect my job. You should be worried about how it's going to affect your job that you're offering me something that I may or may not want. And, of course, there are mostly laws about that. That's why we have harassment laws. So, in fact, what we're looking at is a situation where although people are technically protected by the law, they're not really protected by the law. And if you look further, you'll see that this is true in regard to civil rights and discrimination, where I think the other really crucial moment that we're still living through is the Black Lives Matter moment, mm-hmm. where things are happening that should not be happening. Police are not really technically, theoretically, legally supposed to shoot to kill first, especially unarmed people who they're shooting in the back. They're not really supposed to do that, are they? So we keep perpetuating, and this is where I become a psychoanalyst again, we keep perpetuating impunity because our society keeps a kind of false belief that if we don't protect people who have power, they will somehow be stripped. They'll be exposed. It's not like you can just, as I said, create a form of restorative justice and healing if a policeman does something that is murderous. It's either that person has to be punished and stripped, or the person who's injured in their family has to be denied rights. And the same thing is true, let's say, in terms of sexual harassment. We don't have any other means, seemingly, for adjudicating these problems. So we don't have any way to help people with healing, who, not to say that I think people should remain active as policemen if they've killed somebody, to be honest, but what I'm saying is we don't have any other way of healing that person than letting them stay in their job, seemingly. We don't seem to have any way of healing harassment. So when people don't speak up for their own rights, very frequently, and this, I'm taking this back now to women mm-hmm. who I've listened to, very frequently, they're not just afraid of retaliation. They're afraid of their own power. They're afraid of the way that their rejection or their calling out for help will strip completely the power, the masculinity will castrate, if you will, the other who's violating them. And they feel horrified because it feels as though they're in a life and death situation where one person's interests and needs are going to be completely sacrificed for the other. And women have been taught, all right, I'll be the one to sacrifice. I don't want you to get hurt.
Lisa.
And women have seen a lot of models, and culturally we see a lot of movies and television shows and books that we grow up with these stories of complicated male characters, much more than we do complicated female characters. Some very low percentage of movies pass the Bechdel test where two women say one thing about not another male character, right? It's like 25% of movies. Most of our stories are primarily about men. We have these shows like Breaking Bad that is how many seasons about this complicated villain, right? So we're used to looking at the pain of men and thinking about all the ways that they've been hurt and all the ways, and then excusing the way they're hurting others. And I want to agree with something Jessica said. Absolutely, if someone demands sex from a female in an office, she should not be the one worrying about whether that is going to cause her to lose her job if she turns them down, or, you know, what those negative consequences are for her. You're absolutely right about that. We're not there yet. And
no,
I think
we're not there. It's a failure of our law and our society that we're not there.
Yeah, but that's what the culture would look like. We're not there
yet. I agree,
We've received an email from a listener named Riley. And again, if you want to join this conversation by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Riley writes, thank you so much for bringing up LGBT groups. As a pansexual transgender person, I have experienced aspects of this issue that do not often get discussed in this context. Trying to control a person's gender identity and who they should or should not be attracted to based on their body is definitely part of this issue. I'd also like to mention asexual people, people who have no feelings of sexual attraction. They are often harassed about their feelings, and a form of social domination often seeks to force them to participate in sexual relationships. That's that speaks directly to your point, Jessica, that this is more about power and domination than it is about sex.
Well, I think that, yes, I think that it speaks to the fact that we are more likely to protect those who already have power than those who do not have it. That is to say, there's this inclination to protect the powerful, those who are in the dominant position, as if bringing them down is somehow worse than inflicting suffering on those who are already down. That is to say, we see people who are being afflicted or persecuted as undeserving of protection. It's as if their vulnerability or weakness already makes them undeserving. How did they get to be in this position? They must already be undeserving and weak. And so I think that anything that is declared to be socially anomalous, and that includes all of these different gender and sexual positions that we're trying to make room for in the language of rights, but we still have to make room in our psychology for, we have to own, I think, is what it really amounts to. We have to own the tendency that exists in some sense in all human beings, whether we are among the oppressed or the oppressor, to want to distance ourselves from the person who is being discarded and debased. There is some self-protective part of the psyche that wants to do that. And so learning to overcome that and have compassion is what's usually recommended, but I want to recommend that we all own that we have that part of ourselves. So rather than being like morally righteous about people who aren't compassionate, I think the first step is to own that we all have some of this inclination to protect ourselves by distancing, and sometimes that distance involves, you know, going further than just distancing, involves harming those who are weaker. And I think that's a good start for having compassion for other people, is have some for our own weakness, not just in the sense of being the one who's vulnerable and harmed, but recognizing the harmer and the, you know, the denier inside ourselves.
Yeah. Felicity.
Yes, I'd like to follow up on that because I do think that, you know, there's a part of us that doesn't want to be that vulnerable, shamed person. And that's why the Me Too movement is so important, because people are coming out of the shadows to say, yes, this happened to me, and I'm not the one who should be ashamed of this. But in past generations, that wasn't true. I'm thinking of a woman who went to her mother and said she'd been raped, and the mother's response was, how did you let that happen? And come to find out that the mother herself had been abused as a child. So this is the way that we distance, you know, from our woundedness. But I want to say also, also talk about the power of vulnerability, because I think it's a shame that there are typically many more women in therapy than men. And if you own your vulnerability, you have a chance to heal. If you deny it, you don't.
Lisa.
I just want to say I agree with that, because I think that when we own our vulnerability, part of what we're doing is dignifying suffering. We're actually transforming the suffering, like the women who are standing up now. We're transforming it from a badge of shame, a scarlet letter, into a badge of courage. And that dignifying of suffering is all important.
Lisa.
Yeah, and the people who are coming forward in many cases are being vulnerable and being brave and speaking a thing that has happened to many people. When the Indianapolis Star wrote the first story that named Larry Nassar, the gymnastics doctor.
Which is next Tuesday's show, by the way.
Oh, good lead-in.
This is just a little tiny piece. Okay. That first story that had his name in it also had a point, made a point to say, nobody else has accused this guy. And so the first person who comes forward starts to topple what seems like an unchangeable reality. We side with who we think is winning in these cases, because to do otherwise makes us think maybe we will lose also. It's a way of keeping ourselves psychologically safe, but it doesn't work. And also that bravery and vulnerability to speak about these things of which we've been taught we should be ashamed gives others license to tell their stories as well.
We are getting close to the end of the program, and I'd be remiss, Felicity, if I didn't give you a chance to remind everyone that the Jessica Benjamin is going to be in town.
Yes, so if you want to hear more, and this is an author and speaker who has so much to teach us about the social context as well as the therapeutic context for healing, go to www.cts.edu to sign up for the lectures. If you're a student, you can use the promo code UIndy to sign up for much less money, and professionals get continuing education units for these lectures. Hope that many of you can come.
And lectures are Friday night from 7 to 9 and Saturday
9 to 3 at Christian Theological Seminary.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Jessica Benjamin, Felicity Kelcourse, and Lisa Meese, for what has been a provocative and lively conversation about an important subject. I'd like to also thank our listeners. We're going to be back on Tuesday when, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about the USA Gymnastics scandal here on No Limits. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.